Previously on Beta.
And we are even happier to say that we would love to have you back next season.
Yo, turn it down, man. Turn that noise down, man.
Yo, stop with this.
Turn it down, bud.
You could say things have been better. Or you could say it's not going too great. Or you could say,
not great, Bob.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, author and podcast host Nora McInerney shares her story of losing her husband just a year after they married.
I really did not want to be the last word on Aaron. He was so unique. He was so, so funny. And it made sense for him to really have a say in what that obituary said.
We find out how Nora found happiness in the wake of profound loss. And journalist Jeff Edgers tells us how Aerosmith and Run DMC's Walk This Way collaboration changed our culture.
Hip-hop, which had been like a secret and on college radio, suddenly became the central way that our culture processes art and music.
But first, Damon Young. He's a senior editor at The Root and a columnist for GQ. Now Damon can add author to the list. His debut book is called What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker. It's a very provocative and often very funny memoir exploring the ever-shifting definitions of what it means to be black in America today. A word of warning, Damon uses a racial slur in this conversation.
And so the book starts off by talking about the polar bear plunge, which is this annual event that happens every New Year's Day in Pittsburgh, where a group of people strip naked and dive into the Monongahela River. And, you know, Pittsburgh isn't Wisconsin, but it's usually pretty cold that time of year. And so they're basically jumping into a slush puppy, butt naked into a slush puppy. And without even knowing the people who do this, without even seeing this, I'm certain that the image that props into your head is that these are most likely white people.
Mm-hmm.
And the book starts off with this chapter or with this antidote, because it seems like there are a lot of these measures that sometimes white people take to feel more alive, like the polar bear plunge or like extreme sports where you're like cave diving or bungee jumping or like shark wrestling, or just doing all these things where you're an Eskimo kissed away from death.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the reasons why black people aren't as interested in those sorts of activities is because just existing while black already provides enough thrills that we don't have to invent them.
Yeah, and you use the example of being stopped by the police.
Yeah, and, you know, when you're getting stopped by the police or even when the police just follow you and just all of the stuff that exists in your – all the stuff that's going through your head while that's happening. Is my music too loud? You know, was I going too fast? Am I wearing the right clothes? I mean, and these things don't make really any difference, but that doesn't stop them from going through your head. And just the absurdity that exists when you're having these thoughts and you're having these reactions – that's where the extreme sport analogy comes in.
You say that when you were 17, the thing that you wanted more than anything was for someone to call you the N-word. Why?
Okay, so when I was 6 or 7 years old, my parents basically started a race riot at this neighborhood deli in Pittsburgh because the white kid who was working behind the register called my grandma and my mom niggers. And so they went out and got my dad. My dad came back to the store, asked the kid to apologize. He didn't. And then the race riot to end all race riots starts. And this is a deli, so, you know, there were olives used. There were deli meats thrown. There were jars of jelly smashed. It's just a big mess.
Was anyone hurt?
No one was hurt, seriously. But my parents and my grandma did get arrested, but then they eventually got let go because one of the police officers was a black woman with some sort of authority, maybe a sergeant or something of that nature, and asked them what happened, realized what happened, and basically it's like, you know what, I'm just going to let you go before they realize I'm letting you go, so go ahead and sneak out the back, and I got your back. And so hearing the story when I'm a kid made me a little jealous because I had never been called that to my face before. And I wanted a story like the one my parents had about being called that and reacting in a way that kind of, quote unquote, proved her blackness. It almost became like a sort of rite of passage.
I see.
For me in my head. And my parents weren't the only ones that had that type of story. Some of my friends did. Some of my other family members did. You would read sometimes in the paper or watch on the news about situations where a person was racially harassed and then they ended up turning the tables on the harasser. And again, as a kid and as a young teen, I wanted an experience like that to be able to, I don't know, just to be able to possess that, almost like some sort of video game where each level you go at, you get like a different award or you get like a different like sword or something.
Yeah.
And I wanted that. And then when it finally happened, I was 16 years old, 16 or 17 years old, waiting for a bus, and a person sped by and screamed out the window and just kept driving past. And getting back to that concept of absurdity, I've been waiting this long for this thing to happen, and now I didn't even have an opportunity to react. After it did happen, I kind of just really, and pretty immediately, recognize how, I keep saying absurd, but how absurd it was for me to want to be called this very terrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so since then, and again, we're going back to when I was 16, 17, that desire has basically dissipated where I don't need to experience that to have any sort of measure of my own racial identity.
Yeah. One of the essays in your book is called No Homo. Can you tell me a bit about this essay?
It really deals with the concept of performance and how essential performance is to masculinity. You know, it goes back and it talks about when I was a teenager and how me and some of my friends used to say no homo whenever there was anything, any statement that one of us said that could be interpreted as having homosexual or gay undertones.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you were to say, oh, Marcus Camby from the Knicks had 7 block shots last night, his arms are really long, no homo. And it was this very, like, tongue-in-cheek thing that we would do. And it got to the point where it became so ubiquitous, it was shortened to just no mo, where instead of saying no homo, you just said no mo.
Hmm.
That chapter and that phrase and just that whole experience just really kind of digs into, like, that performance and how, you know, in order to be, like, this very hyper-masculine person that we were aspiring to be, you had to treat people who might be gay a certain way. You had to think of them a certain way. You had to make ironic jokes about them. Sometimes the jokes wouldn't be ironic. Sometimes they would be, you know, with ill intent. Sometimes they would be mean. They were always mean, really, when you think about it, you know, and with perspective and context. And just how essential that performance was. Because, you know, at that point, I don't think any of us really even knew or cared that much about what people who didn't happen to be straight did with their lives and in their bedrooms. But it's like we were taught that we were supposed to care. And also that caring was an essential part of who you were as, like, this straight man or whatever. And then that chapter starts with that story and then segues into an experience I had when I was teaching high school English. At that time, I was really into very form-fitting and very, like, snug pants and fitted blazers, just very form-fitting clothes. And this is going back to, like, 2002, 2003. And that wasn't very popular then. It is now, but it wasn't as popular then.
Yeah.
And so some of the kids at the school assumed that I was gay. And even though at 23, at 24, I really believe myself to be like extremely progressive and without a no homophobic bone in my body or anything like that, that still bothered me. Mm-hmm. And in order to kind of alleviate their suspicions, I did whatever I could to remind them that I play basketball.
Yeah, you were a star high school basketball player.
Yes, I went to college on a basketball scholarship. And so I would do dribble moves while walking down a hallway. If I would walk into a classroom, I pretend to dunk on the doorway. I had a trash can that was underneath my desk. I would move it like 10 feet away so that whenever I had to throw something away, it would become like this impromptu three-point contest. So again, this absurd, that word again, performance.
Yeah.
This absurd performance that I'm going through just because of a suspicion that a few kids might have had.
Yeah. I was intrigued by your writing so candidly about your mental health. You say that you carry dozens of competing and intersecting and self-sabotaging anxieties. Can't be dozens, can it?
I mean, dozens. That might have been some hyperbole there with dozens.
Yeah, I hope so.
Like, I have 60.
Yeah.
But I'm not Black Panther. My book is a memoir. It's not a superhero origin story. And for the memoir to be compelling, it had to be human.
Yeah. I think that the most heartbreaking essay in your book is Living While Black Killed My Mom. This essay is about the death of your mother, Vivian. She died in 2013 after a really hellish stretch of time, 5 years. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, my mom, it'll be 6 years in October. And she had lung cancer, and she had been a smoker for 30 years and stopped about 5 years before she died. And so, you know, if a person smokes for that long, then of course they are more likely to be susceptible to certain conditions, certain diseases. That is true. But the years before my mom was actually diagnosed, she was experiencing this very excruciating back pain, these constant headaches, these stomach aches, which we now know were signs or symptoms of the cancer that was in her body. But when she would go to the doctor sometimes, her pain wasn't taken as seriously as I think it should have been, where, you know, maybe they told her to take some Advil, or maybe they told her to stop drinking so much pop, or to get some more exercise. And again, all those things are helpful. But I do wonder if they would have treated her differently, if they would have taken her pain more seriously, if she wasn't a working class Black woman, if she were maybe an upper middle class white woman.
Which leads you to actually say in the book that being a Black woman killed your mother and that America is a serial killer of Black women.
And my mom, unfortunately, is not unique. I mean, this is a thing that happens with Black people, Black women specifically, in America, which is this advanced country. The infant mortality rates for Black women are terrifying. There are studies that still show that even doctors still believe that Black people have more of a tolerance for pain than white people do. You know, our life expectancy is lower than it should be. Here, I mean, there's so many things that you could cite, so many actual, like, facts and studies that have proven these things that have been circulating in my head and this feeling that I have about my mom. You know, I spoke earlier about just the concept of neurosis, and this particular neurosis exists because I'm not quite sure. And what I mean is that, okay, yes, I know that there are these racial disparities in health and how Black people are treated, how Black women are treated. But am I 100% certain that my mom's race impacted her health and how she was treated? No. I'm 99% certain, but I'm not 100%. And that gap between certainty and the belief that you feel in your gut, that's where the neurosis really thrives and begins to populate.
Yeah. The final essay in your book is called Zoe, and Zoe is the name of your 3-year-old daughter. And you have this great passage in that essay where you write about how Zoe will be exposed to all kinds of things like Toni Morrison and Beyonce, mm-hmm. to Bell Hooks and Black Panther. I'm curious, when will Zoe be exposed to your book?
Oh, that's a great question. My profile pic on Facebook right now is her holding the book.
Oh, cool.
when I got the first copies in the mail, when she's able to read. You know, I will, you know, now some of the chapters, maybe I'll wait until she's in high school. But
yeah, probably a good idea.
When she's able to understand, you know, what's in the book and she wants to read it, then yeah, I'm sure she'll be curious about what Daddy does for a living.
Damon Young is the author of What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker. You can find out more about Damon on our website, wpr.org/beta.
I found myself really struggling with the knowledge that I was happy and that it felt in direct conflict with my grief.
Podcast host Nora McInerney joins us to share her story of falling in love again after tragedy. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta.
Life was really good and normal, even though there was this big, scary shadow following us around everywhere. And then the shadow caught up with us.
Hello.
The brain tumor kept growing back.
This is Aaron.
I miscarried our second baby.
Love you guys.
My dad died.
Talk to you soon.
And a few weeks later.
Bye-bye.
So did Aaron.
That's a clip from Nora McInerney's APM podcast, Terrible, Thanks for Asking. She launched the podcast after becoming a quote-unquote reluctant expert on grief. Nora writes about her losses and moving on with her life in a memoir called No Happy Endings.
Honestly, getting through anything, and I think I am still in the process of going through all of those things, mm-hmm. is part shock, it's part necessity. Mm-hmm. The world does not stop spinning just because yours did. The world at large just keeps moving.
Yeah.
And I think that's something to remember when you are kind of an okay place in your life, that you're walking through this world where you encounter so many people every day and you really have no idea what their world is like, even though you're on the same planet.
Yeah.
I'd walk through Target like, how are all these people just here shopping? And yeah, I was shopping too because I still needed things. But I was like, they don't know. How do they not know? It's just a really very, very surreal experience. I think all suffering, all tragedy is just very, very surreal in that way.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's very well said. Before your husband, Aaron, passed, you collaborated with him on his obituary, and the obituary went viral. Can you tell me a little bit about what Aaron's obituary said?
The thing about an obituary, there's two things that I like to tell people about obituaries. One is that it is so strange to me that we wait until after somebody we love has died to try to summarize their life, also without them. And I'd written my dad's obituary, and Aaron had watched me sort of struggle with that after my father had died. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're like, Is this the most important thing about them? Mm. Am I properly summing this up? And I really did not want to be the last word on Aaron. He was so unique. He was so, so funny. And it made sense for him to really have a say in what that obituary said. And he was so funny. So the night that he entered hospice, he and I sat down in our bedroom and I typed and he talked and we wrote his obituary, and it started with a joke. We would, this is so strange, but we would often, when we were like sort of fake irritated with one another, pretend to be reading each other's obituary. Does that make sense? So Aaron would be in the kitchen and you'd be like, Nora McNerney died age 35, mysterious causes. Her husband noted, why didn't she shut the cabinet doors? Like, I just, you know, why shut a cabinet door? You're going to need to get in there eventually, but that's not here. So I had, we were just going back and forth like that. And Aaron said, you know, died due to complications from a radioactive spider bite. And we just went from there. And he was a huge, huge Spider-Man fan, a huge Marvel fan.
Yeah.
And so we wrote it as if we were, as if Spider-Man had died and we were revealing his identity. And, you know, we sprinkled in some facts. I can't comment on whether or not he was first married to Gwen Stefani, but that was that's a point in the obituary.
Okay.
And regardless of how factually true or not the obituary was, it was so true to who he was. And it was so perfect. And it was really just meant as a little wink to all the people he loved.
Yeah.
Like kind of a final laugh from him when they saw it in the paper. But it went far, far beyond the Minneapolis newspaper. And it did go viral, which was a very strange experience to open up the internet or turn on the TV and see your husband's face.
Yeah. How did that make you feel? Did it, when it went viral and all these, you know, all these strangers were aware of your husband's passing and, you know, tangentially aware of what you were going through. How did that affect you emotionally?
I think that it was sort of, it was comforting in a way.
Yeah.
Grief feels so lonely and it feels so, so personal. Even if you're, you know, surrounded by friends and family, it is something that you carry alone, but, and that you're sure is not affecting anybody the way that it's affecting you. And no, these people did not miss Aaron the way that I did, but it was very sweet. It was very sweet. And it also just reminded me of who Aaron was, which he did make people, anybody he met, just feel like they were a part of something always made everybody feel like they were in on the joke.
Right. You've released another memoir called No Happy Endings. What inspired you to write it?
So about a year after Aaron died, I met a man. And we started the process of falling in love, and I got pregnant, and we got married in that order. And I found myself really struggling with the knowledge that I was happy and that it felt in direct conflict with my grief. I had not had the experience of being in love with two people at the same time before, and I don't know how many people have who aren't widowed, but the prevailing attitude towards love is that you love a person, right? Like, and then maybe you break up or you get a divorce, and then you take all of that love and you pour it into a new person, and the old love has sort of evaporated, and that's kind of how I assumed love worked, and I felt myself in a situation that was completely the opposite, where I still love Aaron so much, and I love Matthew now. And a part of me was afraid that I was afraid to be happy, and I was also afraid that it meant that somehow this new relationship discounted what I had with Aaron and what I still feel for Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
And even more than that, I was afraid that other people would think that Aaron was over for me.
Yeah.
And there's a few reasons for that. The way that we talk about grief, you know, we use a lot of common phrases, things like, oh, closure. Things like, well, you're moving on. And, you know, things like, oh, there's a happy ending. There's a silver lining to this.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, Matthew is not the ending of Aaron. Matthew and our family as it exists now is a new beginning, but it lives concurrently with the family that I started with Aaron.
Yeah.
And my love for Matthew and my love for Aaron, they aren't at odds with one another, and one does not detract from the other. So I know that other people struggle with this, and not just people who are widowed, but people who have gone through all kinds of things, this tension between what they think they should be feeling and what they are feeling, and this tension between feelings that seem to be complete opposites somehow occupying their heart and their head at the same time. So this is the book that came out of that.
Yeah. How did you meet Matthew?
I met Matthew through my friend Mo. Mo is also a widow, and I was definitely looking to leave Minneapolis. Just felt very haunted for me. It felt very difficult to live here, and Mo was trying to trap me, and she invited me over to her house one evening and said, I was very stressed out, and she was like, just come over. We'll burn stuff in the backyard. I love burning stuff, so you don't have to ask me twice. Showed up with like a bag of old medical bills, like, yes, light them up. And we sat in the backyard with our friend Kevin for a while, and then all of a sudden this other guy shows up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the hell? God, now I have to pretend to care about, you know, another person. I've got to remember a new name. And this man, you know, came and sat down, and Mo has these chairs, those plastic Adirondack chairs, you know, that you can get at Fleet Farm.
Yeah, with the fake wood grain, the faux wood grain.
Wood grain. Yeah. I would say they are structurally unsound often, and these ones had been very close to a fire for a while, and this man sat down and the chair completely buckled.
Oh, dear.
And threw him back, and all I saw were his feet flying through the air and then this arc of wine following his feet, illuminated by the fire, and I laughed so hard. And I hadn't laughed in so long that I thought that I was going to be sick or pull a muscle. I couldn't breathe. I was pointing and laughing, which is a great combination. Very, very kind. And he got up, went inside, cleaned himself up, came back out, and reintroduced himself. And I still couldn't look at him without laughing. I spent an entire night laughing in his face. and then I realized he was cute.
Yeah.
And I thought, you should ask me out. And so I told him to. And he did not pick up that not subtle hint at all. He was like, maybe I will someday. I was like, no, ask me out now, you dummy. And the rest is, that's where we went from there.
Yeah. So fast forward a bit, and you become pregnant with Matthew's child. Can you tell me about that?
I did get pregnant pretty quickly. I'd finished the edits on my first book. It was about to come out, and I took a pregnancy test. Oh, maybe a month before I went out on my book tour, and I just thought, oh my God, I'm pregnant. And then I thought, oh God, I'm pregnant. And I truly thought, like, I'm going to stand up there with this record of my love for Aaron, and people are going to see that pregnancy and think, yeah, right. Well, can't be too sad.
No. And to add something else, then your due date for this pregnancy, coincided with another due date. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So we end up doing the math. We figure out when my due date is. It's in November. November is when Aaron died. Mm-hmm. November is when I met Matthew. And November is when the podcast that I was working on with American Public Media was supposed to come out.
Wow.
And as we got closer and closer, I realized these dates are basically the same.
Your podcast is called Terrible, Thanks for Asking. That's a great title. Why did you choose it?
Thank you. It was a rejected title for my first book.
Oh, so really? Oh.
I love when people compliment it because HarperCollins said, seems a little negative for a book about your husband dying. I was like, really? I think it's a great title, but it was rejected. And so I thought, you know what? I'm going to take that title and make it into a podcast. So maybe it's not a crystal ball exactly, but I realized I could find out a little bit about my son's future by talking to somebody who shares a similar past.
I am Ambra Marcos.
Ambra and I went to grade school together, and she stood out because she was beautiful and elegant. She was a ballerina, and she was the only girl in school whose mother was dead.
Can you tell me a bit about the podcast, Terrible, Thanks for Asking, and what you're achieving with it, what you're aiming to achieve?
Yeah, we are just making it possible for people to answer honestly the question that we ask each other more often than any other, right? Mm-hmm. How are you?
Yeah.
How are you? What do you say when someone asks you that? I'm fine.
Right.
Things are good.
I'm fine. I'm okay. Yeah.
I'm great.
Yeah.
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 I'm pretty good. Pretty good. Yeah. I mean, my life is falling apart. I'm pretty sure I'm teetering on a nervous breakdown. Yeah. Can't complain. Things are good.
Yeah.
And there is, there's boundaries are there for a reason. There's a reason why we don't and shouldn't dump all of our emotional problems on the cashier at the grocery store. But when we give everybody in our life the same answer, mm-hmm. it makes it really, really hard for people to be there for us.
Yeah.
And it really creates this sort of prison of loneliness. And I experienced that. I mean, people asked me all the time. And I mean, I would say, I'm good. You know, I'm writing a book. Oh, I'm good. I'm starting a podcast. And that is a hard habit to break,
mm-hmm.
is basically trying to convince everybody else that you are fine and really self-isolating in that way. So we talk to regular, everyday people about a thing that they've gone through or are going through. And we tell their story with empathy but without pity. And we just give them the space to be. And what I want to do is just make a thing. I want to make episodes. I want to make a show where people can point to the thing we've made and say, like, it felt like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't go through this exact thing, but it feels like this. Listen to this.
Yeah, something everyone can relate to. Yeah.
Right.
I think you're doing that. Yeah. How has having these difficult conversations changed your life?
I mean, I was always having these conversations is the mm-hmm. thing. I just now have a job, which is nice.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this podcast came out of the fact that people were sending me these messages all the time and you know, seeing me in the grocery store and being like, oh, my God, I have to tell you this thing. I'm like, great. I have a 2-year-old. In the cart right now, so we're going to need to make it quick.
Yeah. Give me the Cliff Notes version. Yeah,
yeah. I actually think it's at least now I feel helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So it's made me feel useful.
Yeah.
In this world.
Nora McInerney is the author of No Happy Endings and the host of the APM podcast Terrible. Thanks for asking. You can find out more about Nora on our website, wpr.org/beta.
Today, you know, Kanye and Paul McCartney, and I mean, everybody collaborates. There's nobody who doesn't collaborate. But before Walk This Way, there was no such thing.
Up next, journalist Jeff Edgers joins us to talk about how Run-DMC and Aerosmith's 1986 mashup Walk This Way changed music forever. I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon. In 1986, Run-DMC were rap superstars, while Aerosmith was a rock band on its last legs. But when the two groups teamed up to record a mashup of Aerosmith's Walk This Way, they changed the course of music history. The Washington Post's Jeff Edgers documents the saga in his book, Walk This Way. Aerosmith recorded the original version of the song in 1975. The music, anyway. The band had not written the lyrics yet.
So they walk around that whole day, and for some reason they went and they saw Young Frankenstein, the Mel Brooks movie.
Yes.
And if you remember that scene, Igor, you know, meets Dr. Frankenstein, or I don't know how you pronounce it.
Yeah, Frankenstein,
but
that's right.
He met him and he said, walk this way. And he, you know, is all hunched over. And of course, I don't know if that's a PC joke anymore, but then Dr. Frankenstein hunches over. And so when they got back in the studio, they thought that was hilarious, and that became the chorus.
Yeah.
The song itself is really, it's almost like a pre-rap rap. I mean, it's like, it's got the rhythms of like a hip-hop song in some weird way, the way Steven Tyler does it.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. So who came up with this idea to have Run-DMC and Aerosmith get together to record a version of Aerosmith's hit Walk This Way 11 years after it was originally released?
Well, it's not totally possible to know exactly who, but my reporting tells me that it's probably a combination of three people who are friends and talking at the same time. The person who gets credited the most is Rick Rubin, you know, the super producer who produced the record. But Rick Rubin was also talking to Sue Cummings, who is an editor at Spin Magazine, and she was talking to a guy named Tim Summer, who is a friend of Rick Rubin's from NYU. And I think it was one of those conversations where, like, Rick Rubin had an idea that melding rock and rap was going to be a good idea. Somebody in the mix said, well, why don't you get the guys from Aerosmith, which Rick Rubin, I think, thought sounded crazy. He loved Aerosmith from the 70s, and they were heroes to him. And since nobody had done this before, it didn't sound like he'd be able to get Aerosmith. He was like, you know, Tyler and Perry won't do that.
Yeah. Now, Rick Rubin had this kind of punk rock background. He'd been in a punk band called The Pricks, who had played Max's Kansas City in New York City, and they'd been thrown out for breaking furniture. So what was it about hip-hop that Rubin found so intriguing?
Well, I asked him that because I thought, what makes a guy who loves, you know, heavy metal and Aerosmith and those groups, and then has a band that's like Flipper, basically, what makes you go and suddenly get into hip-hop? And his feeling was that he felt like there was a ceiling already for what you could do in punk or hardcore, and he didn't feel like there was a ceiling creatively and also, you know, popularity-wise of what you could get done in hip-hop or rap. And so that's what intrigued him, the idea of, like, pushing against that boundary of something new.
So who pitched this idea of rapping over Aerosmith's Walk This Way to Run DMC?
Well, Rick Rubin came in the studio one day, and what's important is that this beat, the Walk This Way beat, boom, ch, boom, boom, ch, that beat had been used for years in hip-hop. You know, I talked to Grandmaster Flash, and he described lifting a record up and looking at how narrow the grooves were in a store and deciding whether that was a record he could use as a sample. And I found on YouTube the oldest found recorded sample of Walk This Way was from 1978.
Wow.
It's not really a sample. You know, Grandmaster Flash had it on a turntable and just cut to it. But the thing that's important is that nobody in hip-hop used the song to the point that the lyrics came in. So, like, when Steven Tyler started singing, that song was done. And you were a bad DJ if you allowed it to get to that point. Huh. So one day, Rick Rubin walks in the studio, and he sees Run and D there, and he says, what are you doing? And they're like, oh, we're just working on a song. And they had Walk This Way, the beat, on the turntables. And they were doing what they wanted to do. They had the beat, and they were going to do, like, we're Run DMC, it's a place to be, I went to St. John's. You know, they were going to do their own rap over the beat. And Rick Rubin said, you know that's Aerosmith, right? And they're like, who? They didn't actually even know it was Aerosmith, because the way the DJs did it is they took a record and they would scratch out the song title because they didn't want people to steal their beat. So what they knew was, hey, this is number four, Toys in the Attic. And Rick Rubin, you know, again, it's 1986, so we don't have Genius or Google or whatever. He tells the guys, go listen to this song, and he gives them a notepad, and he gives them the record, and he has them go to Daryl's basement. And DMC and Run sit there and transcribe it.
Yeah, so what did Daryl McDaniels and Run think of Walk This Way the first time they actually heard the lyrics?
When they heard it for the first time, what they said was, this is hillbilly bull, bleep. That's what they thought.
Great
they
bleep.
They hated it. They hated the fact that this beat that was beloved had all this scraggly white guys singing stuff. They hated it.
Yeah, so they wanted to write their own lyrics? Did they want to rewrite their own lyrics?
They just wanted to do what they normally did, which is get a beat and then do their own rhymes over that beat. You know, that's how all the great beats were used, whether it was, you know, like Billy Squier's The Big Beat or Walk This Way. That's how they were used to doing it. Bear in mind, it's like, again, to skip ahead, today, you know, Kanye and Paul McCartney and, I mean, everybody collaborates. There's nobody who doesn't collaborate. But before Walk This Way, there was no such thing. You just wouldn't have two rock guys and two rap guys going into the studio and doing something together. Just think about it. I mean, you can't come up with another example when you try to think of it because it didn't exist.
Who convinced Run and Daryl to do this?
I think part of it is that Jam Master Jay was like that silent and also not so silent leader. Mm-hmm. And he was always in the studio with Rick Rubin, listening, watching. And I think he knew that they were going to have to come in. And also, it wasn't like they were like given an ultimatum. They were just like told, hey, get down here and do this. You know, they were kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they came in and, you know, it was like going into the studio. They brought some, you know, some Big Macs. They sat in the corner. It wasn't like a formalized thing. But basically, Jam Master Jay yelled at them.
Okay, so who pitched, let's look at the other side of the equation, who pitched this collaboration idea to Aerosmith's lead singer Steve Tyler and lead guitarist Joe Perry?
It went from Rick Rubin talking to John Kolodner, who was the superstar A&R guy at Geffen Records and had signed Aerosmith and had been very upset because Aerosmith had been in disarray. Joe Perry had quit the band for mm-hmm. 5 years. He had come back, and they had produced a comeback record, quote-unquote, called Done With Mirrors. Came out in 1985, and it had not done well. So Kolodner was like sort of at his wit's end. But he said, you know, why not? And then he called Tim Collins, who was Aerosmith's manager at the time, and Collins went to Aerosmith. And it's really hard to know now exactly how they responded, but, you know, I've watched this video of Aerosmith getting interviewed at the time, and it's clear to me that they don't really know what they're getting into.
Yeah, we've heard them. We've heard them on the radio before, yeah.
Yeah, and I like their style because there's a lot of electric guitar in it, you know. And
finally.
Yeah, right. And it caught my ear. So when I found out about this, I was like, you know, real excited. As you can tell.
You know, like you can tell that they don't actually know each other. There are other things that are going on that are so fascinating. You're watching Jam Master Jay at his turntables, and he's got two copies of Toys in the Attic, one on each turntable, and Tyler and Perry are standing over him, and he's cutting from the beat on one to the beat on the other and then back. And what he's basically showing those guys is, hey, your song doesn't mean anything to me when you start singing, dude. And you can see Tyler and Perry just kind of like, I don't know what's going on in their brains, but I think at a certain point they're taking in and realizing these guys don't really like this song that much, you know?
Yeah.
So it's amazing to watch that. And then also just watching, you know, Run and D, one a major thing that happens is they actually didn't record their final rap for that song that day, even though everybody thought they did, because they didn't take it seriously enough. And you can see them rapping with their little you know, crinkly yellow page of lyrics in front of them, and they're just goofing off, and they're saying things that are kind of profane at times, and they're not taking it seriously.
Surely it's y'all. This is it, y'all. Surely it's y'all. We make a record with Aerosmith, y'all.
The song was released on July 4th of 1986. How did the public and critics react?
Well, I mean, the public reacted by making it the biggest hit of Run DMC's career and the first crossover rap hit. And, you know, the reason really is, and that in itself isn't amazing. I mean, there were a lot of terrible hits at that time. I mean, Aha was riding high, right?
Yes, on me.
But what's important is that it reached the public, because what happened is the song came into WBCN, which was the rock radio station in Boston, and a powerful rock radio station that other programmers followed. And they were a station that considered Aerosmith like their hometown band, you know, the Bad Boys of Boston.
Sure.
And so when that record came in, and it was a song they knew from the 70s, and the two lead guys of Aerosmith were on it, they put it on the air. And that was exceptional because rap was never played on rock radio. Once they did that, MTV then felt comfortable putting a Walk This Way video into regular programming hours, not like at 1 a.m., you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how that song then reached the mainstream.
As you say in your book, Aerosmith and Run DMC's collaboration on Walk This Way was more than a top 10 hit. It changed our culture. How did it change our culture?
The things that happened right after Walk This Way are clear and obvious. And it's not just in music where you had, you know, Public Enemy and Anthrax, or you had bad things like Limp Bizkit, you know? But you also had basically, hip-hop became part of our culture, which it hadn't been before. So Yo MTV Raps emerges after that. On TV, you've got the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, you've got In Living Color, you've got Arsenio. And, you know, on that record, Raising Hell, it's the first hip-hop merchandising deal, which is My Adidas, and Adidas paying Run-DMC $1 million to market their sneakers. So that's what I'd say changes. And, you know, like, how far do you draw that out? I mean, do we say that, you know, a black president? I don't know, you know, but I'm saying that something changed. Hip-hop, which had been like a secret and on college radio, suddenly became the central way that our culture processes art and music.
You say that it's important to consider race as it relates not just to Walk This Way, but to Run DMC in general. What is it about race that we should be thinking about?
Well, my main thing is, you know, the people who set the stories and write history are the winners. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, this book is full of central characters who aren't that well known, but I'd argue were just as important, if not more important, than the characters we know. So Rick Rubin, who I hold nothing against, but Rick Rubin does LL Cool J's record and the third Run DMC record, and he's on the cover of the Village Voice called The King of Rap.
Yeah.
Larry Smith, who produced the first two Run DMC records, the Fat Boys, and Houdini's records, you know, in a 2-year period, he's like Phil Spector. I mean, he's got like multiple platinum records. You go on the street and, you know, or go to South by Southwest and ask 100 people who Larry Smith is, and I bet you 99 and a half wouldn't know, and the last one would say, was he in The Clash?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, yeah. The reality is Larry Smith was a pioneer. He created Run DMC's original sound, and, you know, the fact is Walk This Way is the most important Run DMC song, but it's certainly not the best one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sucker MCs, I would say, is a better song. Rockbox, which had an electric guitar on it that Larry Smith produced, is a more important song in some ways. So Larry Smith, or, for example, someone like Grandmaster Caz, you know, who is an amazing, amazing central figure, the Cold Crush. Run DMC looked up to him endlessly. And Grandmaster Caz does hip-hop bus tours now, which is not, they're not bad, but you could pay $70 and go through New York on a bus with Grandmaster Caz as your guide.
In her New York Times review of your book, Baz Dreisinger asked the question, quote, "What does it say about American culture that for an African-American art form to receive its due, it had to not just seek white validation, but cloak itself in the trappings of whiteness?" End quote. What do you think the answer to this question is?
I would take a little issue with that only yeah. because I don't think that Walk This Way cloaked itself in whiteness. Mm. I think that there were two white guys contributing, but unlike, for example, Ice Ice Baby, and I admit it, Vanilla Ice is an easy target, but Walk This Way is an actual good song, and Run DMC is central to that song. And I'd argue that that song is better when it's sequenced in the actual record.
Mm.
So you got to ask yourself the question, and it's a super complicated question that I can't really answer. But the question is, you know, is it a bad thing that sometimes we embrace things based on the fact that that's who the programmers are giving us, you know? I mean, we're basically, the reason Walk This Way succeeded is because the programmers, the people in charge, decided to put it on the air. And, you know, there's a huge argument or debate going about whether MTV was racist, right? Because
yeah.
I've got people in the book saying their programming was racist. You know, they were racist in how they discriminated against black artists. What MTV would say is we weren't discriminating against black artists. We were discriminating against something that fell outside the format. Our format was rock music. So if you were Stevie Wonder, or you were Michael Jackson, or you were Aretha Franklin, or Marvin Gaye, or Billy Ocean, you fit inside that rubric. But if you were Grandmaster Flash, or the Fat Boys, or Run DMC, you didn't fit.
Yeah.
You know, Russell Simmons said an amazing thing to me. He said that the black record executives and the black publications were actually slower to embrace rap and hip hop than the white ones. He said, we got on, you know, Rolling Stone before we got on black publications.
Hmm.
And he said that there was a feeling the African-American executives looked down on hip-hop. They felt like it was not as cultured, and they embraced, like, Peebo Bryson and, like, you know, rhythm and blues and soul music, and that was the battle there. So it's a really hard thing to figure out.
Jeff Edgers is the author of Walk This Way, Run-DMC, Aerosmith, and the Song That Changed American Music Forever. You can find out more about Jeff and Walk This Way at WPR.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
You don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle.
Our technical and music director is Steve Gotcher.
He's freakish big and freakish strong, and quicker than you'd expect for a man of that size.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
He's prettier than both my daughters. He's young, but he knows how to lead.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
There are few men of honor in the capital. You are one of them.